this isn't a good start.
Oh, boy.
Thanks, Steve.
Those having some headphone trouble.
Will I need them today? I don't know if I'll need them. I will need them. All right. Hi, everybody. It's Bill F. It's Wendy Snyder. Welcome to the show. It's Wednesday. Dr. John Duffy will be by later on. And then also, I'm so excited to see this documentary called The Vietnam War that Ken Burns has put together. I've never seen Ken Burns not do anything really, really well. No matter what topic he decides to tackle, he just tells a very full, complete, wonderful story. And they're doing this PBS series called The Vietnam War. We're going to talk to a guy, a Vietnam veteran, Glenn Haney, who has already seen the documentary and gives us his thoughts as to what we'll be seeing.
Quite honestly, I know there's been a lot of movies made about the Vietnam War, a ton of them, but I don't recall learning a very lot about the that war in high school. I really don't. They didn't spend as much time on it.
Not enough.
Exactly.
Definitely not enough, especially since we were of the age. We were kids when it was happening, but we, you know, it was certainly in our collective memories.
It was still being digested, though, I think, offer an excuse for history teachers.
Whether or not it was good, bad, or both.
Or just, I'm trying to think of a current example. Clearly, they would teach September 11th in schools now. But
of course.
I had a history professor once who, and this was in the 80s, he taught American history, and he said, I won't teach anything after World War II because it's not history yet.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because, you know, you have to sort of figure out how things fit and how it all goes together.
But you know what? When you think about it, he's right, but then he's not right at the same time because it's already happened. It hasn't fully been digested.
But one day can be history.
Well, it hasn't formed with historical context
the
and how one thing leads to another. And
I can accept that.
You know,
sure.
And in the late 70s and early 80s, it was still very raw.
But
you
even
know,
now, I don't think that's a high concentration of history classes.
I don't think they do.
I think they should all be required to watch this PBS documentary.
Yeah. It's 18 hours. Well, they would love it.
We had this class in high school called SEMSEN. It was called, short for Seminar Centered.
Yeah.
And every other day, you would have classroom, and then the other day you would do audio-visual stuff to learn about it. It was super cool.
Oh, that's nice. That's very good.
So this would work in perfectly.
Yeah.
Had this been around then to watch it.
Anytime, like, I'm trying to think, I guess baseball is the one that meant the most to me. I watched the one about the Civil War, but anytime Ken Burns decides I'm going to spend some time on a project, he just doesn't do like a quick fly-by-night version of it. He gets as in-depth and in detail as anybody I've ever seen. I remember I had him on when I was at WLS. He came up to the studio, and I said, I can't imagine what it's like when your kids ask you to read them a bedtime story, because for most of us, we just do Goodnight Moon and then a kiss on the forehead, and it's all over. I said, but you, sir, you have an attention to detail that's unparalleled.
He has to start at 2 p.m.
Right.
I got to be honest with you. I don't know that I'm 100% familiar with Ken Burns. Would you do a little splaining?
He's a documentarian. I'm trying to think.
Is he a household name?
Of documentarians, he is probably currently the best known. Would you agree with that, Steve?
I think so.
I think he's probably the guy, if you're new to documentaries, although his are, like we said, much, much, much longer than most. The story he tells is from every direction. You know, no matter what his topic is, you get such a 360-degree view of it. He's a master at that. The one about baseball, which was, I think, the first one I ever saw him do, he got not only former players and managers and sports writers, but he got politicians and actors and like the most important people telling their version of what baseball meant to them. And it was just stunning. It was so good.
He has been making films for more than 30 years, since the Academy Award-nominated Brooklyn Bridge in 1981.
No, I never saw that.
Why am I not more familiar with him?
Every time because he takes such a long time on it, he does one about every two or three or four years. But when he does, like this one about the Vietnam War, he's kind of front and center. He's kind of all over the place. So you certainly know that one of his works is coming.
It's interesting, too, because we're so impatient now. And, you know, I know, to sit down and do anything or read an article more than 400 words or whatever, that people are willing to put aside the time to watch his movies. I mean, it's one of the rare things, I think, that people can do that.
I bet it's a hard sell for people to commit that much time. But now we've come to this stage where you can binge watch things, where an entire season of whatever your favorite show is, you'll just sit down and watch it over a weekend. So maybe that works in his favor. Maybe now our attention spans, which are, everybody says, getting smaller and smaller, maybe part of our brain is willing to accept, if we do like something, to give it time.
But that's interesting that you say that, because I sometimes think maybe I should just blow off a season of a show so I can sit down and watch it back to back to back to back to back.
Yeah.
Because I love that. I mean, now it's like I can't wait for the next week.
Yeah. Right.
So I don't know. Do I blow off watching it live as it's happening and wait so I can binge watch it?
I imagine a lot of people are going through that. The whole way we do almost anything now has changed because it's so easy to do it this way now.
So is that our attention span getting better or worse? Because
it's both.
It's impatient because you can't wait a week for your new show, but your attention span is pretty good if you're going to sit there for 18 hours and watch something.
Yeah, without a doubt.
I don't know.
So I don't know if the Vietnam one appeals to you, but find something of his, go into his catalog, because he's done probably 8 or 10 of these at this point. Find one that seems the most attractive to you and give it time, because I can't think of anybody who spends as much time on a single topic as he does. And really, like, you'd go, oh, do you want to watch 14 hours or 16 hours about the Civil War or baseball? Yeah, you get so wrapped up in it, you don't want to stop.
Is it? I know he's got the baseball one, but are his other documentaries mostly centered around historical events?
Yeah.
Well, baseball was history too.
Yeah, it was the history of baseball. And then what he does, like, I think the first one when it came out was 12 hours for baseball. And then what he did was on, I think, the 10-year anniversary, he went, well, you know what? A lot of stuff has happened in the last 10 years. So then he goes back and he throws down 2 more hours of
really?
It. Yeah.
Wow, he's conscientious.
He doesn't give up on anything.
Well, I mean, that's the one class I did not pay attention to in high school at all was history.
Oh.
I know. And
you've hurt Steve's feelings,
but can I just say that I regret it immensely? My kids both are really into history, but I don't know. For some reason, it was just like that was my one class. Like, I loved science.
Yeah.
I even liked math. Speech class was great. But when I got to history, it was like, yeah, too much information being thrown at me. So I want to watch every one of these now.
A friend of mine who had a similar mindset to you said there was just too much of it, and which made me laugh.
I know.
But he said,
there's
too
much history.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
speaking of digesting it.
You never get caught up. Yeah.
Right. There's no, you could binge watch history. You could start now. You would never, ever, ever get caught up. But with your other classes, at some point you go, oh, yeah, okay. I know enough about science, or I know enough about math or whatever. But with history, you just go, boy, in every direction. There's European history, there's world history, there's American history.
Too much information. Too much information.
But getting back to your original point, I don't know, because it's been so long since I've sat in a school and taken classes, but I know that there were certain things that they didn't spend enough time when I was in school. And then from talking to my daughters, it is that way. Vietnam is a major, major event, and yet in a lot of schools, it gets, you know, a day or two or three is mentioned in history class, and then they move on.
That surprises me. Kevin wants to jump in on our conversation. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hey, Wendy. Hey, Bill.
Hi.
How you guys doing?
Really good. What's up?
Wendy mentioned you with all of his stuff was basically historical. My favorite Ken Burns documentary is called Jazz. It came out in, 2001, 2002.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 10-part PBS series. It's really well done. It goes through pretty much the musical history of America. And it's like, I was telling the screener, it's like almost like a college course, Jazz 101. It's so good.
And Kevin, wouldn't you agree that it's great, like in the case of jazz, it was certainly great to hear from jazz musicians, but it's also great to hear from people from other walks of life explaining the importance of jazz in their lives too, right?
Right. Did you see it?
I only saw a little bit of it. I wish I had seen the whole thing.
You're not a jazzbo, are you?
Not enough. I appreciated what I saw, but I didn't get to see all of it, no.
I talked to you guys about a month ago, right before the eclipse. I was the guy who went to Mexico and Washington and went down to by St. Louis. Did not disappoint. It was fantastic.
Worth the trip?
Did you cry?
Pardon?
Did you cry? Did you get emotional when it happened?
No, screaming and yelling mostly in happiness, because there was a black cloud right in front of the sun, and it passed like 1 second before totality. So everybody went from being really disappointed, because it started to rain, too.
I'm telling you, that was the cloudiest day we've had all year, was Eclipse Day.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not exaggerating. 1 second before totality, the cloud moved and everybody just went crazy. It was really cool.
Good timing.
7 years.
Kevin, thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. So aside from that jazz documentary that Ken Burns did, he also did The West, Thomas Jefferson, Lewis and Clark, The Journey of the Corp of Discovery, Frank Lloyd Wright. I mean, this guy did everything.
Yeah.
Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Horatio's Drive, America's First Road Trip. Unforgivable. Boy, I made up a word. Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, who was a heavyweight boxing champ. He's covered everything. The War, the National Parks, America's Best Idea, Baseball, the 10th Inning was the one you were referring to.
Well,
Prohibition.
10th Inning was the add-on.
Oh, I'm
so
sorry.
It was originally Baseball, and then the 10th Inning was the one he came back and did, I think, 2 more hours on.
The Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. The Roosevelts and Intimate History. Why have I not known of this man?
Oh, yeah. And I think it's almost exclusive. I'm trying to remember if he does it for sources other than PBS.
It looks like most were PBS, PBS, yeah. PBS broadcast, PBS.
Yeah.
It looks like it. Wow. I learned something new today,
so
Bill.
So how about that? All right. So later on, we will talk to Glenn Haney, who is a Vietnam vet and has already seen Ken Burns' documentary, The Vietnam War. We'll get his thoughts on it. That's at 10:35. A lot more coming up on today's show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
You make me want to go there and watch the documentary that you and Ken Burns are putting together.
Well, what I would do is I would set up a little screen for you in the back seat so you could watch the documentary on the way there.
Wow.
We'd have food at Ishnala. You'd enjoy it. And then you could watch another episode or two on the way home. You get everything done in one day.
You must really love that place because we've never gone out to dinner together.
I think twice
in our whole years together.
I so want to go there. I didn't realize until I heard the commercial that they're only open till October.
Yeah, May through October. That's it. It's so good. This is the place I went to as a kid. When I was a little kid, I went there and I loved it. And for years and years and years, I went, could that place really been as good as I thought it was when I was a kid? And then Terry and I went back a few years ago and it was even better. So, yeah, you'll love it. It's good.
All right. Rosetta wants to talk to us. We were talking about Ken Burns' new documentary about the Vietnam War. And Bill and I both kind of questioned. I just texted my son, Michael. Have your teachers spent a lot of time on the Vietnam War in school? Currently, he goes to COD. I'm just curious. I haven't heard back from him. But Rosetta, you had a thought on that?
Yes, I do. I'm that generation, and I believe that your history teachers may well have been from my generation as well, and we have extremely mixed feelings about that whole part of our history.
So, Rosetta, for a teacher to take it upon him or herself to talk about it, it could be considered controversial, right? There could be some backlash to it?
Probably, and, you know, it just all, even now, still seems unresolved.
Yeah, I imagine that's true. Yeah.
But you say that, and for people that haven't learned about it, we want to know why, you know? I think that needs to be explained a little more than it has been.
Oh, I get that, but I'm just saying, at the time you guys were in high school learning history, I think the teachers would have had a lot of emotional difficulty trying to present it fairly.
That's a good point.
I wonder, though, Rosetta, do you think if a teacher says, hey, what we're about to learn, you know, it is controversial, and there are pluses and minuses to it, so we'll try our best to be fair and impartial. Is that possible, or would the teacher's slant just be inevitable?
It would be hard to work around it, but I think, you know, that could have been said. Depending on which day, I mean, I'm thinking several days in the class.
Yeah.
Some kids might have missed that, too, statement.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Rosetta, thank you very much. Good points, all of them. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed the show.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks,
bye.
Rosetta. Michael texted me back and said they didn't really teach a lot about it. We have learned surface level about it every year, but never really delving very deep into it.
So does the school make that decision, or do the teachers individually make the decision about how? I mean, I know you only have X amount of time in a semester. So who divvies it up and says, we're going to spend a day on this, but a week on this and 2 days on that? I don't know who. That's probably the teacher, right?
I would bet it's the whatever the program is for the class, the syllabus.
Yeah.
And then they decide, because I can't imagine like one teacher would teach more about that than something else. It seems like every class would be basically the same material, especially in high school and middle school.
In one of my classes, one of my history classes in high school, I remember they spent a lot of time about the colonization of the United States. And I kept thinking, I know how important this is, but I would also watch the attention wane from the class. And I'd say there's been so many more significant things that have happened since the 1700s.
Now, name two.
Don't gloss over this. I'm trying to think of where I would start.
But you need to know, that's the stuff that, and this is going to sound awful, it is kind of boring as you're going through it, but when you think about it as an adult, it's like, oh my God, that's how it all started. But as a kid,
yeah,
you're like, yeah, blah, 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 give
the
me something
Jamestown
interesting.
Jamestown settlement, I loved all that
all
stuff.
All of that's important, but Steve, when you were in school, didn't you look around, and although there were certainly...
No, he was so busy loving it, he didn't look around.
The
book?
I spent my junior year in high school dressed as 19th century presidents.
And that began a friendship with John Williams,
yes,
that stands
it
to this
did,
day.
Yeah. And a love of mutton chops.
All right, we'll take a quick break. And then Steve will give his recipe for mutton chops. Boy, are they tasty. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
In this dirty old part of the city. All right, the soundtrack for the Vietnam War is certainly something that we've gotten used to. But as we were talking before, we're going to chat with our guest. I didn't learn a lot about the Vietnam War in high school, and they still cover it, but they don't go in depth. You mentioned this Ken Burns documentary.
Yeah.
That is going to be 18 hours. And we have a Vietnam veteran, Glenn Haney, on the line with us, who is the author of When I Turned 19, a Vietnam War memoir. He served in the U.S. Army 20 years, numerous awards under his belt, including the Purple Heart and the Silver Star. Glenn, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Good morning, Wendy, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for being here, and as we always say, thank you for your service, Glenn. It means the world to both of us, to all of us listening. Glenn, talk a little bit about your participation in the war. What happened there?
Well, Bill, when I was 18 years old, my brother and I flew to Vietnam together. His name's Wayne. He was 20, and like I said, I was 18. And once we arrived, they didn't really know what to do with us, so they held us in a holding area for approximately 6 weeks, and then my brother went to Korea, and then I reported to my platoon in the AmeriCal division.
Now, was this a choice of yours? Did you go enlist? Were you drafted? Forgive my ignorance on some of this stuff.
Yes, I enlisted in the Army. My father was a career Army serviceman, and we were taught service to country was important. So right after I graduated from high school, I did enlist in the Army.
And Glenn, you put in 20 years, which is a huge chunk of time. When was that decision made that this wasn't just going to be a quick couple of years, but two decades of service?
It was actually after I came back from Vietnam, and about 8 or 9 months after I got back, actually, I got married. And so I decided to go ahead and re-enlist in the Army and make the Army a career at that time.
And I haven't seen, is the Ken Burns documentary even out yet? When does it come out?
No, it's starting this week, I believe.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
10-part series spanning 18 hours. Go ahead, Glenn. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh no, I'm sorry. It is out. It started on Sunday, so we're already gone through three parts so far of the documentary.
And you've seen this. We want to get your take on this. There has been some gushing. There has been some critiques. What are your thoughts on the Ken Burns documentary, Vietnam War?
Well, Sunday and Monday was mostly covering the history of Vietnam and what's everything that had occurred up to the point of American involvement. And I guess last night, it started with President Johnson and actually how we got involved in committing troops to Vietnam. What I'm apprehensive about is, as we get further into the documentary, is how the American soldier and the Vietnam veteran is going to be portrayed. I'm in hopes that the soldier and the veteran will get the respect they deserve.
Have you seen or heard anything that would lead you to believe otherwise, Glenn?
Well, politics always comes out, and so if it becomes the documentary stays or becomes very political, then the American soldier that fought in Vietnam may not get his due. And I can say that through my experience with all the men that I was with in 1st Platoon, they're the finest and bravest men that you would ever want to meet, and are very honorable people.
You said you're 18 years old, you enlist, you just get out of high school. How were you prepared for what was going to follow?
Nothing could prepare you for war. You can watch movies, you can read books, and you can have people talk about it. But nothing's going to prepare you until you're actually on the ground and you witness war.
Glenn, have there been things that have happened to you over there that you still to this day have not discussed with anybody?
Well, Bill, yes, that's true. Even though when I wrote my book when I turned 19, it's pretty revealing. But there's still some things that occurred to me in my platoon when I was in Vietnam that's not even in the book, that's very personal.
There are, you know, on Facebook, there's a lot of friends I have from high school that talk about, you know, their sons have been deployed, their daughters have gone. What advice do you have to parents? Because I just don't think I could sleep at night knowing they were out there.
Well, I actually had three sons that were in Iraq and Afghanistan. David, my oldest son, was in Special Operations. Nathan was in the 82nd Airborne Division, and Brian was a Ranger in Afghanistan. And unfortunately, I didn't really talk a lot about war itself, but if I had to tell them again, I would talk about how war creates fear within yourself, and that fear is going to come home with you.
You say you didn't talk about war very much. I think that that's what I'm understanding, that a lot of Vietnam vets have not really discussed things. Is that changing at all?
You know, it is changing. Matter of fact, within the past year, it's the first time I've worn a hat or a T-shirt that announced that I'm a Vietnam veteran. When my book, When I Turned 19, was published, a lot of my neighbors didn't even know I was a Vietnam veteran. I even have a neighbor, I've lived in the same cul-de-sac for 19 years, right across from me, that is a Vietnam veteran, and we did not know that each other were Vietnam veterans. And it's something we never really talked about, to tell people, hey, we're Vietnam veterans, because we were taught to be pretty much ashamed of that fact. And now we're out, we're talking, and we're hoping that documentary will bring people around to realize what good people and what good soldiers and men that served in Vietnam are.
Glenn, something must have happened that changed your mind. If you kept it, you didn't keep it a secret, but you didn't really flaunt it at all. And at some point you said, you know what, I'm going to let people know I'm a vet. What happened?
I think it's through the recognition that the Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans received.
Yeah.
Now, this is a sad story. You know, my sons came home from Iraq and Afghanistan, as I stated earlier. They had a grand welcoming home. They had parades. They had family and friends and people within the cities they lived greet their aircraft as they landed. I was actually envious of that, as petty as that may sound, you know, for my sons, because we received none of that as Vietnam veterans. So I think we're coming out, and as the Afghanistan veterans are met on the streets, the people are saying, thank you for your service. And then we started saying, hey, we are Vietnam veterans. And now people are greeting us and telling us, welcome home and thank you for your service.
Glenn, it's a story we've heard so many times, that the guys would come back from Vietnam after, you know, risking their lives on a day-by-day basis, and the American public just didn't know how to react to them. What was that like for you when you came back and America maybe didn't know how to react to you?
Well, I do have a short story. Is when I went out to meet my friends right after I got back, you know, at the local hamburger joint. Most of them just kind of acted like I was gone for a vacation. It's kind of like, hey, Haney, where have you been? And nobody really asked about, and they knew I was in Vietnam, but nobody asked questions, and I didn't volunteer any information. And I was certainly different. I was no longer that 19-year-old kid out of high school where my friends were still that way. So it was difficult, but I was fortunate that, because I stayed in the Army, that I was in a military community and surrounded by soldiers every day. So I think the impact on me was probably not as great as a lot of the people that went in and had civilian jobs and lived in the civilian communities.
In your words, and we're talking to Glenn Haney, he's written a book that I have got to pick up and read when I turn 19, a Vietnam War memoir. You've been in the Army for 20 years, received a Purple Heart and a Silver Star. In your words, why didn't America know how to react when you guys came home?
I think because America watched the war on TV, and it wasn't, and it was unfiltered. You know, World War II, they showed film of our servicemen fighting World War II, and all the film that they watched was filtered. Mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and wives and girlfriends literally watched their loved ones die on the battlefield or be wounded on the battlefield. And I think that really had set the mindset for the American people. And again, when America doesn't declare war, and we send our soldiers to fight, to us is a war, but you're not having the support of the American people or your country behind you.
But it's not your decision. You were receiving orders to go and fight this war. That's why I don't understand why we didn't thank you when you came home.
Well, we didn't either. You know, it was surprising that the American people was actually bitter, you know, show bitterness and to the American soldier. We were doing what we were told to do. We took an oath to serve our country, and just like any other generation.
Do you think about it every day, Glenn?
Every day.
Yeah.
I had 13 platoon members die when I was there, and I say their names every day.
We'll talk more. You can stick around, I hope, Glenn, right? Are you okay time-wise?
Yes, I can.
Glenn Haney is here, highly decorated and deservedly so.
I want to hug you right now, Glenn. I wish you were in the studio.
Well, I feel your hug, Wendy. Thank you.
Well, that's so nice. If you'd like to chat with us, we would love to hear.
The Vietnam War. There's a 10-part series that has started on PBS. Ken Burns has put this together. And on the line with us right now, a Vietnam veteran, Glenn Haney. His book, When I Turned 19, A Vietnam War Memoir. We have a lot of listeners that would like to talk to you. Are you cool to take phone calls?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
All right. John wants to talk. Hi, John. This is Glenn Haney.
Yeah, I was wondering if the soldiers talked about the strategy of their leaders of especially like not attacking North Vietnam's. I thought the war was unwinnable if you didn't attack the home base where they were infiltrating from. Did the soldiers ever talk about the leader's strategy?
Well, yes, we did. You know, the strategy, of course, that's a very high level. You know, we were more interested in the support, the fire support from air and artillery. But yes, you know, the bombing of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, there was times that the president stopped the bombing, or the bombing of North Vietnam, they stopped bombing. And we wanted the bombing to continue because we knew that was going to help us. We would have less people we would have to fight along the way.
John, thank you very much for your question. Dennis is on the line. Dennis, you're a Vietnam vet as well?
I am. I served over there in 67, 68. I got hit May 16th. I want to say that when I came back, just a real quick story, that the neighborhood had a welcome home party. One of the, it was either the Sun-Times or the Trib, put a picture of me being welcomed by my folks. About a week later, I received a letter in the mail, an anonymous letter, saying it was too bad I was welcomed home by my parents and not in a casket. So that's not just some urban legend. That happened to me specifically. It's not something that I'm relating from someone else. There was a lot of divisiveness. There was a lot of people just didn't respect what we sacrificed and we did to serve our nation. I'm very proud of the work that I did over there. I think a lot about the people that we deserted. We had a lot of good South Vietnamese people that worked side by side with us. And just want to say to Glenn, welcome home. And I thank God that I'm not one of the 58,000 names that are etched on the wall.
Dennis, thank you so much for your service.
Happy for that, too. And welcome home to you also.
Thanks, Glenn. Appreciate it.
I can't, it just blows my mind to hear this. I was too young to understand what was going on when you guys returned. Maria has a thought on this as well. It just blows my mind hearing it from two veterans here. Glenn, thank you again for being with us. Maria, your thoughts?
Hi. Thank you also, Glenn, for your service. I was a flight attendant during the late 60s, early 70s, and I think there was so much social turmoil going on within the United States, and it never occurred to me until much, much later, so many of the soldiers that were coming back, individuals on flights, they'd go back in the bathroom. You know how tiny the bathrooms are. And then they change into civilian clothes. And it never, ever occurred to me until much, much later that maybe they wouldn't be received very well. And I also want to say, at our local schools, as many other schools do, when we have our Veterans Day programs, that we always ask, you know, the people that served in the military, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, Coast Guard, et cetera, to stand up. And you can almost see there's a hesitation with that age group of the Vietnam, like, well, what's going to happen to us now? Are we going to be well received? Yeah. And I think it's coming so much more forward how we should be receiving the soldiers. And I am watching that Vietnam special, and I'm apologize, I don't remember the lead platoon leader, and when they were leaving, where they were trapped on the hill forever, maybe Bill remembers his name, and he was saying this was the finest group of soldiers he had ever served with, and it was so moving to see. So I think we're coming around slowly.
Hope so. Thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
Thank you
very much, Maria.
Glenn, help us with this. For those of us that didn't serve, we didn't fight in a war, you did. What's the question that you wish we would ask you, and what's the question that we should not ask you?
Wow, that's a, Bill, that's a tough question there. You know, I've had people asked about, you know, did you kill people? And of course, that's not a question you ask anyone. And I guess the question that you should ask is the support to the country that they provided, and maybe why did they provide the support and others didn't?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Dennis is on the line. He is a Vietnam vet as well. Hang on one second. I hit the wrong line. Bill, can you fill for a second while I do this? You're not going to?
No.
All right, here's Dennis. Hi, Dennis. You're a Vietnam vet as well. Glenn Haney on the line with us.
Yeah, good morning. A couple things I'd like to say. When I was there, I was 20 years old. I was a commissioned officer, which you sort of wonder how you can be a commissioned officer that early, maturity-wise. The majority of people I served with were probably under 25. All we knew really was that the government said to be there because we were fighting communism. If you look at that war and many since, it's all politics. It's all up to the people really in Washington who consistently made bad choices. We didn't really talk about politics much over there. We relied on the wisdom of our leaders and forefathers and did our job. We didn't lose in Vietnam. We left in 72. We were supposed to support them. We did not provide that support. Consequently, the North took over.
Glenn, your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree completely. That's one of the things I've talked about. But first off, welcome home. You know, in my lifetime, we've been fighting wars for over 25 years, counting Korea, Vietnam, and Afghanistan, and Iraq. And it's simply because we have not declared war in any of those conflicts and have some type of plan and resolution of how we're going to conduct a war and how we're going to end the war and what's going to happen after the war. And so that, I think, by not doing that and allowing a president to just do executive orders and commit troops is too dangerous.
Dennis, thank you very much for calling. We appreciate your story.
So, Glenn, based on what we were just talking about with Dennis and with yourself, there's a phrase, those who don't understand history are doomed to repeat it. What do we take from what happened in Vietnam, and how do we apply it to the wars we're fighting now or the potential wars? North Korea is a very, very scary situation for all of us. What do we learn from Vietnam that we apply to those wars right now?
Yeah, North Korea is very scary at this point. Again, I go back, we have to hold our president and congressional leaders responsible. They have to be transparent. We have to demand answers. And again, we have to have the will as a country and as citizens to declare war if that we're going to go into another country for combat operations.
First of all, thank you for being with us today. I loved you saying to the other vets, welcome home, and we can say that to you. Is there anything we as a country can do to make up for the treatment you received when you came home?
Well, I think what the country can do now is the citizens continue to recognize the brave and fine men that fought in Vietnam, and just let them know that you're aware that they did do their duty, and you're appreciative of that.
Thank you, sir. We
Very
really
moving.
Appreciate everything. Glenn Haney is his name. And again, the book is called When I Turned 19, A Vietnam War Memoir. Pick it up. It's a great read. Thanks so much, Glenn. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bill and Wendy, for having me on the show.
Absolutely. All right. We'll take a quick break. We've got some news. And then Dr. John Duffy joins us. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Hey, cue ball.
Wow. Wow. That was quite a depiction, Wendy. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and our friend Dr. John Duffy joins us. He is a highly sought-after clinical psychologist, but in a good way. It doesn't mean it doesn't
mean
you're
way?
Being chased by the law or anything like that.
No, not at all.
Best-selling author, certified life coach, and a frequent guest here on our program. How are you, John? Nice to see you.
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
All right, love and marriage. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. So I got to thinking about the fact that we've all been married for a long time, and I've been working with more couples who've been married for decades lately than I have in 25 years. And I've been wondering, like, okay, so what's going on here? And thinking about, like, what makes for longevity and satisfaction in marriage. And doing a little research, you find it's not what you think, because sometimes you think, oh, it's going to be common interests, or you have to be able to resolve conflict really well or spend time together.
Don't cheat on them.
Don't cheat. That's a good one.
Right.
That's often a deal breaker. But the thing you find most often is if there's fondness and admiration, kind of consideration of one another. Like, and if you think about those words, fondness and admiration,
yeah,
after decades of marriage, we often don't take the pause to let our partner know, hey, I'm really fond of you and I admire you. We're busy. We are raising kids. We, you know what I mean? So to do that, to take that moment means a lot to the satisfaction and long-termness of your marriage.
Yeah.
What are the best ways to do that? You're not going to go, hi, I'm fond of you, honey.
Nope. The best ways to do that are just consideration, like, you know, date nights, spending time facing one another. So if you think about the time we spend with our spouses, oftentimes we're facing the same way, or we're looking at different screens. We're not really addressing each other. We might be in the same room, but we're not talking. And we're not talking about our future and what we picture together. We're not looking back and talking about, like, what brought us together in the first place? You know what? And sometimes that stuff reignites, you know, a marriage that might feel like it's getting stale.
Right.
You know?
Don't you think, John, that couples need to find, and it's not an easy formula, but you need to find some sort of formula of just the right amount of time together and just the right amount of time apart?
This is no small thing, Bill. So I'm working with a couple of couples right now who spend the vast majority of their time together. And you would think, like, how great is that?
Yeah.
But that doesn't always work. Like, you think about fondness and admiration, and it doesn't leave a whole lot of time for any mystery or anything interesting or anything to talk about, because we just spent all day together.
Right.
So
right.
I think it's important to spend time apart and be interesting to one another and have something to talk about when you're sitting across from each other at dinner that night.
Yeah.
So that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Something that hits home that you said that really rang a bell was not facing the same way. When you're with your spouse, you're not facing the same way. And we're at that age where it's either watching a son perform or play a game or do something, we're together participating, but we're looking at our kids.
Right, right. So we probably all three are afflicted with the same issue that we're crazy about our kids, right? And so a lot of the ways that we connect are through our kids. And so as our kids get older, and we've all got kids in the, you know, late teen, early 20s ages, it's important to reconnect with our spouse and talk about them and each other and what we want to do in this next chapter of our lives, you know? And that should be exciting. For too many of us, it's like this grief stage, you know? And that's okay for a short period, but at some point, that's got to be exciting. Like, you know, what do we want to make of this time? Now we've got this free time that we can spend together. We can spend a Tuesday night going out when we couldn't have done that for the last 20 years.
Right.
And so to take advantage of that time is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last weekend, Wendy already knows this, but Terry picked me up right after work, and we had a weekend, just she and I, and we do this 3 or 4 or 5 times a year, just a weekend somewhere close by. And I feel sorry for couples because we look over at other tables during dinner or when we're walking around town, wherever we end up, and you just see like they've had their fill of each other. When for us, it's an incredible time. We've been together more than 30 years. I so look forward to those weekends.
That's so great, and it is so heartbreaking, isn't it? Like, you know, because some couples establish a ritual that can go on for years and years and years.
Yeah.
But the ritual is joyless, right? So if it's like, okay, we're going to go out to the same restaurant every Friday night, and where we'll sit there in silence.
Yeah.
You know, it makes for decent people watching if you're at the other table having fun with Terry.
Right.
But if you are at that table, it doesn't connect you. You know what I mean? And there's not much hope affiliated with it. But if you decide, let's talk about something. Let's talk about what's going on in the news, or let's talk about what's going on in our lives. And what do we want? Like, let's reignite the dreams we had 20, 30 years ago. And if you can do that, then you've got something that you can build on together, you know, instead of separately. Because sometimes we lead very separate lives and never really fill our spouses in on what's going on in our lives.
Right, yeah. Right.
I was reading this article on the internet, so it has to be true. Actually, it was just an opinion piece, but it really also hit home. A lot of times a spouse will say, you've changed. You're not the guy or not the girl I married, but that's a given. We are going to change. Our lives change, so we need to kind of embrace that change.
Right, and appreciate that change, right? Especially if that change is progressive. Like, you've grown. You've changed in a way that I really admire, you know, because I didn't know you were headed in that direction, right? Instead of like, you know, I'm really disappointed in the way you change. The other thing we do is sometimes the things we're most drawn to initially become these things that get under our skin. And I think we need to find another way to look at those things too, you know, and really appreciate all those little elements about the person we decided a long time ago to commit to for our lives. There's a reason we did that, you know?
It's a lot of work, and anybody who says it's not is a liar. I'm sorry. Being happy, Kevin, you're celebrating your first anniversary on Saturday when the world is supposed to end. Hope that doesn't happen. But it is not only a commitment, but you have to put effort in on both parts, don't you?
Yes. And so the only issue I'll take with you is I don't think it's work. I think it's just attention. You know, I think if you depict it as work, it feels like, oh, it gives that ball and chain kind of, you know, I got to spend time with the idiot kind of thing, that shtick that we bring to marriage, instead of like, you know, I want to spend time with my wife, or I want to spend time with my husband and kind of get to know them again in some fresh way. You know, like there's a difference between that and like, oh God, here comes the work part, you know?
Well, you have to invest in it. Like, I want my tomatoes to grow, so I have to water them and feed them. You have to do that with a marriage as well.
Definitely have
Is
to
Is that
invest
better
in
than
it.
Work?
I like that a lot better.
All right. Any questions or comments for Dr. John Duffy? You know how to reach us. We're at 312-981-7200. We'll take your calls and questions next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Our friend and our clinical psychologist, the show's psychologist, Dr. John Duffy, in the studio with us. Check out his podcast, Undue Anxiety. You can find it wherever your favorite podcasts are found, or at WGNplus.com. And you can also check out his book, The Available Parent, his website, drjohnduffy.com. We were talking about investing in your marriage. We have a phone call. Do you mind taking it?
Not at all.
Jan's on the line. Hi, Jan. Dr. Duffy with you.
Hi, Wendy, and thank you, Dr. Duffy. Yes, I have a question. Married 49 years and 6 months. It'll be on Saturday.
Wow.
And we are in dire trouble. We've gone to a therapist counselor and couples counselor, and we did the technique mirroring.
Yes.
Where we, okay.
And well, we don't know. What is that, real briefly,
okay.
John?
Okay, Jan, tell me if this is the exercise you engaged in. Mirroring tends to be kind of taking each other's point of view and expressing it to make sure you understand what your partner is saying. So it's almost like role-playing. Is that roughly what you did, Jan?
That's exactly what we did. And with the therapist there to guide us and keep us on track, we did very well and we had breakthroughs. We tried to do it a couple times on our own, and we have, but it seems to get fragmented. The one thing that has bothered me actually for several years is my husband's inability to look at me in my eyes when he's talking to me about issues, that sort of thing. I mean, he can turn and look at me and, you know, what time does the Cubs game start and what time, you know, all this and that. He's looking at my eyes. But when we are talking about a personal issue, or he cannot look at me, and that happened even in the couple's therapist office as well. I mentioned it to him, or to the therapist. I said, he's not looking at me. So she said, you know, said his name, and please look at your wife. And
because it makes you feel like he's not listening to you if he's not looking at you.
It does, and I just briefly, I was trying to compare, does he do that with everyone? We were visiting his mother and his mother, and he were talking, and his eyes were not taken off of his mother at all. And I watched him intently. So I do think it's a sign of something, and I'm wondering, Doctor, even though this may hurt my feelings, I'm wondering if you would share with me what your thoughts are on someone that has difficulty doing that.
Well, I think the news is probably not as bad as you think, Jan, because I don't think this will hurt your feelings. I can imagine exactly what Wendy's saying, that there is this inclination to take that very personally. But a lot of people, and men in particular, have a fear of intimacy. You know, you are the person who is most intimate with him. And so I don't know if we could go back 20 or 30 years and see if this is something that's been going on in your marriage forever. But what I would encourage, on top of mirroring, and I would continue to do that with a therapist, is to really talk to him without accusation, without shaming him, about what that really is about for him. And he may surprise you, because he may have some insight, and he also may have no idea that he's doing it. But if he knows that he's doing it, he may have no idea why. So to have a meta level talk about, you know, why is this? This has been going on for a long time. And just knowing that it hurts your feelings, that it affects you, that might get him to work on it in a way that he never has before. So I would encourage you to work in those two ways. Keep mirroring, but also talk about like this particular phenomenon and why it might be taking place. And you will get somewhere with this. You know, you guys have been together for a long time. There is a reason that a marriage lasts 50 years. So there's something to build on there.
Good luck to you, Jan, and you'll make it to 50.
I appreciate your comments, both of you. Thank you so much.
It's hard to hear those words. We've been together for 49 years, and boy, are we in trouble. As soon as she said that, my heart dropped. Because you go, that's almost 50 years. Right. So there has to be something working. Just find it.
Right, exactly right. I mean, you know, like people... there's a reason that people stay together, and sometimes you have to mine that after all this time, because marriage, like any relationship, over time becomes habitual. And so we forget what drives us when we're just acting out of habit. So, you know what I mean? If it comes, I walk in the door, I hang my head on a hook. Hi, honey, I'm home. And I sit down and read the paper, you know, old school. And people can do that for decades and decades and decades, right? And never think about like, wait, what is this relationship about? What is our lives together about? Right. Let's talk about that. And that might be what Jan and her husband are running into, is just not taking that beat to talk about, like, what is our relationship about? Or what's it about now, not 49 years ago?
Yeah.
Can almost every marriage be saved, would you say?
I think...
That's a tough question to answer.
The vast majority of marriages can be saved. And in the circumstances in which... people drift apart or they no longer have things in common, I think it's okay sometimes when marriages end. You know, I've worked with teenagers who talk about their parents, and their parents are absolutely staying together for the kids. And the kids will say, you know, in the same hour, good God, I don't know what keeps them together. I wish they would just do it and break up already. You know?
Because staying together for the kids doesn't help the kids, does it?
Not at all. Not at all. And kids are keenly aware of it. And we have to remember, we're modeling relationships for our kids. And we want them to have good, happy, strong relationships. And if that means, okay, we, your parents, aren't getting along the way we used to, but yeah, we're going to co-parent together, well, that's fine. You know, that shouldn't be the end of the world.
We saw more than a handful of couples when our daughters graduated 2 years ago, and I'm sure you saw the same thing, and Wendy, you probably did too. Our kids are about the same age. Several couples broke up right after their kids graduated from high school because they thought in their heads, they really don't need us to be together anymore,
right?
So why are we together?
It's, yeah, this is a fallacy a lot of people live under, is that, you know, like, until the kids go to school, off to college, we're going to stay together,
yeah,
and that does no favors for the kids. So if that's the reason you're staying together, I encourage you to revisit that at the very least.
John, here's a happy text. My wife and I just celebrated 25 years together because murder is illegal.
Thank goodness for the little things, right?
Yeah, it is the little things. This isn't fair to ask you with only a minute, but this text is a tough one, too. What do you say to somebody who is married to a longtime alcoholic? That's got to be quite a challenge, huh?
Yeah, and that's where in marriage, I think non-negotiables are underrated. And this is an area that is non-negotiable, because when you're married to somebody who is actively alcoholic or actively depressed, mentally ill, something like that, the throwdown has to be, if you don't get help, then I can't be in this relationship, because it's not a relationship in this iteration.
Right.
But if you do, I'll stick with you and I'll support you.
But aren't there then some feelings of abandonment? There'd have to be, wouldn't there be?
Absolutely. There's got to be therapy.
Yeah.
So along with AA and a whole, it takes a ton of work. But I've worked with marriages in that circumstance that can be saved if you're willing to put in that work,
yeah,
and you're committed to one another. But it has to start with, like, kind of reinvigorating the relationship and getting well.
And when you give that ultimatum, like, you know, we're done unless you get help, that should be said, because that person needs help.
Absolutely. And the ultimatum is a real thing,
yeah,
right? It's like, you know, I'm not going to stay in this. It's not healthy for me to stay with you if you're not well.
I always put everybody else first.
Sure.
I got to learn to start thinking about me.
Sure.
So, absolutely. Bill, wrap this up. And
all right, I'm wrapping it up.
Let's get going.
I am. That's Dr. John Duffy.
Thank you.
You just heard. His podcast is called Undo Anxiety. It's at WGN Plus. Very, very well done podcast. And then the book is called The Available Parent. It's sold wherever books are sold. Thanks, John. Appreciate
it.
We'll take a quick break, then some news. Stay here, Bill and Wendy, WGN. All right, before anything else, Wendy, I just want to preface this by saying that I know that our show has been clown-heavy over the past couple of weeks and months. I get that. There's been a lot of discussion about clowns and how creepy clowns are.
Very popular now because of it.
Yeah, very popular because of it, which, by the way, broke the box office record for the month of September. More people saw that movie, It, in the month of September than any other film in the months of September ever.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Why haven't you seen it yet?
Too scared. Too afraid.
Are you going to see it?
I think I can wait until it's on DVD. I don't know. I guess I should see it in the theater, but I don't know. I know the story inside out. I don't know. I'll see it.
I'm kind of surprised you didn't.
I am too. That's the kind of movie, when they make it,
know,
they know I'll be there. I'll see it though, but I don't know. All right. So that said, you know, anytime you and I have discussed clowns in the past, we've told you stories about people who have done things dressed as clowns. When they started showing this movie in theaters 2 weeks ago, people took it upon themselves to dress like Pennywise the Clown and come early and just sit in the theater and hold a red balloon so that when people would walk in, they'd be creeped out by it.
And you make fun of Star Wars fans?
Yeah. I go, I am a Star Wars fan. But it gets...
Who dress up, I guess.
It gets weird. And we've tried to figure out why we're afraid of clowns, and the reason we've come up with in the past is that clowns kill people. All clowns kill people. Or most clowns kill people. Our legal department phoned me. Most clowns kill people, not all clowns kill people.
All right, you're safe. Now.
Bozo has never killed anybody.
And Ronald McDonald.
Ronald McDonald has never killed anybody, but all other clowns have killed people.
Does the Burger King count as a clown or not really?
No, he's royalty. He's not a clown. Now, this story... In a sea of crazy stories about clowns, I believe, may be the craziest.
Oh, talk to us, Bill.
Wait till you hear this. This takes place in nearby Ohio. An Ohio man allegedly, now they have to say allegedly, but there's all kinds of evidence that everything I'm about to read to you happened.
Because he hasn't been convicted
yet.
He's
not been convicted, right. So the word allegedly must be scotch taped to the story. But believe me when I tell you, there is no reason to believe that anything that I'm about to tell you didn't happen. An Ohio man allegedly donned a clown mask as a means of scaring his young daughter, which led to his arrest and that of a neighbor, according to police. Now, you say to yourself, okay, that's already eerie. A guy decides he's going to scare his little girl, so he dresses like a clown. But why would his neighbor be involved? Oh, wait. Police were called to a Boardman Township home just before 10:30 p.m. when a woman dialed 911 with a report of a small child being chased by a man in a clown mask. According to police, a police report that was obtained by WFMJ, the girl then ran into an unlocked neighboring apartment and asked the family inside if she could stay there because a clown was chasing her.
Poor kid.
Awful, right? The apartment's occupant was a 48-year-old man, Dion Santiago, who reportedly told police that he shut out the lights and looked out the window and then saw a man dressed as a clown in the yard. That's when the cops say Santiago fired his gun through the window at the clown. According to the report, Santiago told officers that he had not pointed the gun at the man in the mask, but he did because he was chasing this little girl. Police said, you'll be shocked to learn, they smelled alcohol on Santiago, who reportedly admitted to officers that he had been drinking a few beers when the girl entered his apartment. Officers arrested Santiago on the charge of operating a firearm while intoxicated. As for the clown, cops said that the girl's 25-year-old father, Vernon Barrett Jr., told them he decided to play a prank on his daughter to discipline her. You know when your kids do something wrong and you say to yourself, there's only one way to show them what's what. I will put on a clown outfit and chase them down the street. I'm sure you've had that happen a couple times.
He's a young father, man. He's got a lot to learn.
25 years old. Barrett reportedly said he didn't want to physically punish the girl because her mother had been jailed for breaking some of the girl's ribs. Oh, this story just gets better and better, doesn't it?
Jeez.
Barrett was then arrested and charged with child endangerment and inducing panic. Both men are due to be arraigned on Tuesday. Now, do they share a cell together when all this is happening? Because that's awkward. I would ask, I'd say...
Separate rooms.
I know
I want
that
private.
I understand that overcrowding is a huge problem in today's jail system, but if you could not put me in a cell with a man dressed like a clown, I would greatly appreciate it.
Can I just say something? And I don't own a gun, and I don't understand how gun laws work, but if you see someone terrorizing a kid...
You want to shoot them with a gun filled with seltzer water.
Oh.
That's the correct response to this sort of behavior, is you fill a Super Soaker up with seltzer water and spray them all day long.
Now, I wouldn't do that. I would let the girl in and call 911, but if someone is chasing a little girl... I mean, wouldn't a lot of people shoot at that clown?
Instincts, even if he wasn't chasing her. Even if, if you just look out the window and you go, there's a clown in the yard. Where's my Smith & Wesson?
But this girl was terrorized.
Right.
She's asking for help.
She has no idea this is her dad, obviously.
He just had a mask on. She couldn't figure out, boy, those look like dad's legs.
No, because he was wearing striped pants. He was wearing full clown regalia.
Vertical or horizontal stripes?
Vertical, more slimming.
Yeah, so he looks thinner
slimming.
Than her dad.
Right.
She was used to seeing him.
This is not true.
I know that my dad, 25-year-old Vernon Barrett Jr., he's put on a little weight over the years, but this clown is so slim, it can't possibly be my dad.
Poor little girl, and mom's in jail for abuse.
Yeah, a lot of stories have a hero, but everybody in the story, well, you know, the girl, you certainly feel for, but everybody else in the story, it's just terrible.
Can I just tell you that I get this sinking feeling that Ohio is turning into the Florida,
the new Florida.
Midwest. Right. I can't tell you how many stories of these we see every day.
And a lot of them do emanate from Ohio, just as over the last couple of decades, it's almost always Florida.
See, and everybody complains about living in Illinois because the taxes are so high, but...
No. We have nothing to complain about.
I haven't had clowns running around here for a couple decades.
Phil wants to talk to us.
Yeah.
What, Phil?
I was going to say other than government, but that would have been rude. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that.
Hey, Phil.
Hey, Bill and Wendy. Well, first of all, Bill, you don't use a super soaker. You're supposed to use one of those flowers.
Oh, yeah, water, right. A giant daisy. That's okay. What you should use,
just
right?
Just want to set the record on that one.
No, you're right.
You're talking about clowns and being scary and all that, it reminded me, I went to grade school with the daughter of the original Sven Gulli. In fact, didn't you have Rich Coase on?
He was on yesterday. The original was Jerry G. Bishop.
Yes, and but I think that was a stage name. I don't know, because my friend's last name was different, but it was his daughter. So I think they lived in Riverwoods. I grew up in Deerfield, went to grade school. And she told me a story about one time he came home from a show. I think he used to do it on Saturday nights, if I remember. And he
Friday
came
nights.
Home with full makeup on. Friday night. And he came home with full makeup on and just scared the bejesus out of the family. So, I'm sure the makeup was pretty similar to what the current Sven Gulli has.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had that thought creep into my mind, as a lot of other strange thoughts. So I thought I'd give you a call.
Well, it worked. Well, thank you
so
much.
Thank you for sharing.
Yes, appreciate it.
I feel better now, so thank you.
Good. That's why we're here. When I was a kid, not the neighbors right across the street, but one down. So is that officially Kitty Corner? I don't know how Kitty Corners work. I guess
it is. And
thank
you for saying Kitty Corner and not Catty Corner, because I hate when people say that.
I don't
have
the culture to say that. All right. So he decides one time he's going to scare his kids, the guy who lived in that house. And I don't know where you would get one if you needed one, but he did. He found a gorilla outfit, and his goal was to go up to the patio window. He's going to walk around his house and then show up at the back of the patio window in a gorilla outfit and make gorilla like gestures so that his kids think, oh no, there's a gorilla in our backyard, which is always funny.
What is wrong with people?
I don't know. But what he hadn't planned on was, when he went around to the side of his house, the people who did live across the street from us have a giant sliding glass door, so they see a gorilla making its way between the houses, and they call the police. And the police say, because Oak Forest had little to no gorilla activity up until that time. So they accuse our neighbors of having, you know, too much to drink, which wasn't the case at all. They said, no, there's either a gorilla or something that looks like a gorilla that just made its way. So there's all kinds of squad cars all over the neighborhood all of a sudden. And he's there in his backyard. He's got a gorilla outfit on. So he's explaining it's all in good fun. He's not really a gorilla, he promises.
Did he get arrested?
No, they didn't arrest him. He got a stern talking to and, you know, a warning not to dress like a gorilla anymore.
Did you kind of like that neighbor more after that? Because you like a good prank like that.
I have respect for him, yeah.
I don't like any of that prank stuff. I just really don't.
But you have to know in the back of your head when you're planning something like this that there's always an element of surprise that somebody could see something they're not supposed to. Something could go wrong. You have to be ready for that.
How do you be ready for
that?
I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Boy, fun in Oak Forest.
Yeah, it was a good time. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then there's a lot more show. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Don't forget, everybody, at noon, you got a couple of options. I think both of them are good. They look good to me, anyway. At 12 o'clock, Wendy and I head toward the stream, the internet. You can find us very easily by going to WGNradio.com. It'll instruct you on exactly what you need to do so you can hear our bonus hour. That's from 12 to 1 o'clock, or keep your dial set right here on WGN regular. We're on unleaded, where Steve Bertrand will do
the
Wintrust.
We're premium.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, could be. Steve Bertrand will give you the Wintrust business lunch. So at 12 o'clock, two different options. Both of them safe, mother-approved, kid-tested and mother-approved. I want to bring Ryan Burrow into this. Ryan, can you hear me right now? Because this is a story that you first brought to our attention earlier this morning. And this takes place in Wisconsin, where a school is doing something a little proactive, I guess. What's going on there in Wisconsin?
Well, it's just about 20 miles west of Milwaukee, and this school has told parents and students that, look, before you come to our school dances, whether it be homecoming or prom, we'd like to see a photo of you in your dress, not for a fashion show, but they just want to make sure that it meets the school dress code standards. Their concern is that some of these young ladies will show up to the dance and essentially be turned away because there's too much front being shown, there's too much back being shown, and what have you.
Can I tell you, seeing a lot of my friends' kids and even strangers on Facebook, a lot of people post their kids that are going to either prom or school dances. Mm-hmm. I can't believe some of the midriff-bearing dresses that are popular now. And it's not one kid. It's all the kids that are wearing them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot. There is a lot of skin showing. I'm not a prude or anything.
No, of course
I'm
not.
Just saying.
Right.
It's, you know, when I went to my homecoming dances, it was like spaghetti straps were in, but, you know, it was no cleavage was showing.
Right.
You'd show your shoulders. And, God, back in the 80s or late 70s, you'd have like a stupid shawl that covered your shoulder.
Right.
But these, I mean, have you seen some of them? They have backs that drop down to their plumber's area.
But do you guys think it's weird that a school district would ask a bunch of 15 to 17-year-old girls to see pictures of them in dresses? Is that a little
and
awkward?
And who's the guy checking out the pictures? The custodian?
Like well.
Mr. Brimhall in the custodian's office. This one's passing for sure. What has been the reaction there from students and parents?
You know, this is actually a policy that's been in effect for a couple of years. And, yeah, they've gotten a little bit of pushback. Some of the students say, I don't want to be sending them pictures of me in my dress.
I want to reveal it at the dance.
Exactly. Well, and some of them think it's kind of creepy. Now, they did just revise their policy this year, saying that we will accept instead an email from a parent who says that they understand what the rules are and their child will comply with the dress code rules.
Do you have the dress code rules?
I don't have them in front of me right now, but I know that the big issue seems to be how much back is shown.
Baby got back.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot. Have you seen these pictures? They're very revealing.
I haven't seen any pictures, but having had two daughters going through it, you know, I saw what they wore. I saw what their friends wore.
And you let that happen?
Well, they neither of them were dressed
provocatively.
Yeah, I wouldn't call either of what Reese or Kylie wore provocative. But here's what I keep thinking. If I'm a kid and I'm going to this school in Milwaukee, I would I guess a girl, I would submit one picture and then wear whatever dress I wanted.
Then they won't let you in.
It has to match the picture.
Well, but they have the dress code, and that's what they're trying to prevent is turning you away at the door after you've paid for your.
All right.
You little.
I thought that
trollop.
Would work. My plan has been thwarted.
Take a picture of your 1880s Quaker outfit and then show up. Yeah.
This is what I will wear.
Yeah.
And then wear something far more slinky, like I do when I attend dances. Well, that's interesting. I wonder if more schools will start to follow this as the norm, do you think, Ryan? What do you think will happen?
I don't know.
I don't think this
seems kind of strange to me. I'm not sure.
I do know more and more schools are complaining about the dress code just in everyday classes, and then when it comes to the dances, it gets even more looser, I guess.
I'll tell you, we had the superintendent of Evanston High School on when you took a day off.
Mm-hmm.
And since they got rid of their dress code, they've had less issues.
Yeah, I know. How do you explain that? It doesn't make sense.
Because we all have that rebel inside us. And when someone says, don't do it, what do you want to do?
Right.
And here's the, I don't know how to say these. It's not Milwaukee. It's
Pewaukee.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's how you say it?
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, the Pewaukee dress code, like many others, prohibits clothes deemed too revealing. It explicitly bans tops that have spaghetti straps.
Mm-hmm.
That's next to impossible.
Because of the carbs. Everybody's a lot more carb conscious.
Carbs have turned into the devil.
Everybody's more conscious of the carbs.
They cannot be backless and or the ones that cover only one shoulder, which are very popular now.
Sure they are.
Blouses that do not cover the midriff and shorts and skirts to extend below the mid thigh.
Mm-hmm.
But now that's just dress code for school. But for
a dance, though.
I can't find the dance one. But a lot of them have been super sexy.
Yes.
I wish that was an option.
Like, it doesn't sound like dances are that fun anymore. I don't know. Do kids still do that?
If I can't dress sexy, I'm not coming to the dance.
Well,
that's my rule.
I just wonder. I mean, are proms and homecoming still big?
But kids go as groups a lot more frequently. Like, we couldn't go to our dance if we didn't have a date. Which, in my opinion, is just forcing you to
hook up.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But now they'll allow, like, big groups to go, and that's what a lot of the kids... There's still some people who have boyfriends and girlfriends, but I'd say...
Go as a group.
The majority of them
seem to... Wendy went with the Teamsters Union.
Can't they do a virtual prom?
Yeah.
Throw some Pokemon out there or something and let the kids have some fun.
Do it
there
that way.
Yeah.
Bonnie, you have a suggestion?
Yeah, I actually thought, you know, with how tech-savvy kids are these days and everything, what's to say that the kid isn't going to send the email to the school district saying that that what they have is perfectly okay from the, quote, parent, end quote?
Because I bet they'll have to get an email from the parents.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, same deal. I mean, if they see a bad dress coming up, they're going to turn you away. It's just a matter of if you're surprised or not, right?
I guess. Yeah. I think it's dumb. Thank you, Bonnie.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Bill's a trollop.
I am not a trollop.
If you were a girl, you would be.
If I was a girl, I would be. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll find out what Steve has coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.